is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 1:29. We are Nation Radio here until 2 o'clock this afternoon. Joined on the line by Bob Stauffer. Bob, how are you this afternoon, man?
Good, Alan. How you doing?
Good. Hey, I got a question to ask you right up front, and I know you'll take this in the spirit in which it's passed along. Are you now, or have you ever been in association with Trina S. Oil?
No. I wouldn't put it past Trina's Oil that this individual perhaps listens to the Team 1260 and maybe monitors the rights holder station in town as well. So, that question has been posed to me 3 or 4 times. And, when you have an ego like I do, you're going to put it out there yourself. You don't need to do it through a fake alias.
Well, you've never actually been seen together in public, so I just wanted to know. Talk to me a little bit about two Oiler prospects signed yesterday, Taylor Chorney, Ryan O'Mara. Both are what I would characterize as bubble players, in that there's a job for them, but they're going to have to fight for it in the fall. Tell me if you think either will make the team, and if they do, in what role they'll play.
I think that Taylor Chorney will make the team, and I do not think that Ryan O'Mara will. I think that Taylor Chorney is, and for the record, in that draft year, I wanted the Oilers to take Chris Russell, and he ended up sliding further down in the draft to Columbus. They liked Chorney. That was during a range in which they drafted a lot of guys from about 2001 to 2006 or so out of the NCAA, and several of them did not pan out, including, you know, Eddie Caron and Colin McDonald. Those guys were wingers. I don't mind NCAA defensemen. Chorney is on a two-way deal, but he needs to clear waivers, mm-hmm. whereas Jeff Petrie does not. And Corey Potter does, but, you know, I mean, several other organizations could have had him through free agency. And the Oilers stepped up for the Potter signing. So in my mind, it's really between Petrie, Potter, and Chorney, with Chorney having the advantage because he can be claimed off waivers. Petrie, of course, could probably use some more minutes down on the farm. With the addition of Barker and Sutton, I think the Oilers have got a top six, so they don't have to force Petrie into a top six. But if he comes in and dominates right from the get-go, then you got to keep him on the team. And the wild card in this, Alan, is Ryan Whitney. That injury that he has takes, I know it takes football players a full year to get it back, to get that fiber twitch back in that foot. So we'll see, you know, whether or not he's 100% right from the start of the year, because that might impact Petrie as well.
Is there a sense, Bob, and I don't want you to tell anything out of school, but is there a sense that the Oilers aren't done because of the Whitney problem?
I don't think it's a significant problem. I think that it's a concern that you have to, you know, understand that he had a pretty serious surgery done, and sometimes it takes time to recuperate. I think the Oilers are done right now on defense. The Chorney deal, you know, my guess is that, we're looking at, you know, Whitney and Barker, and not necessarily in these tandems, but say Whitney, Barker, Schmid and Gilbert, Sutton and Peckham, and then Taylor Chorney is a seventh defenseman. With Petrie getting, you know, with Petrie and Tubert in particular getting top 4 minutes on the farm, playing in some combination with Potter and Brian Helmer. Brian Helmer's not listed on CapGeek.com, but he is on an AHL deal in the Oilers organization for another year, and that would put Plante in a third pairing. And either with a guy like Taylor Fridun or Johan Motin. Now, I wonder whether or not they don't address that through an AHL free agent as well, just get a little bit more depth and experience there, but not on an NHL deal, because I got them right now at 49 contracts. If 49 contracts, but two guys on EL slides, so entry-level slides, and that's Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Martin Morenson.
Is the Colton Tubert acquisition, was that the death knell for Alex Plante? Did that really sink him as a prospect in the Oilers organization, in your opinion?
Sorry, which acquisition?
The Colton Tubert acquisition. They're somewhat similar as players.
Well, I think again, as you know, because you were over at Shanks that day with us. I mean, that draft in 2007, those final two picks, Alex Plante would have been a fine second-round choice, but to step up and take him 15th, I thought, was a reach at that stage, and history has proven that that's been the case. And don't even get me started on Riley Nash. You know,
I know you loved him.
I'm still angry about that to this day.
They
salvaged it, though, Alan, when they made the Marinson. They used that pick to trade that pick to Carolina for Carolina's second and traded Martin Marincin.
I still remember that because I came over after the first round had begun, and the look on your face was I thought you were going to actually leave orbit there during that first round.
You know, and I wrote a pretty critical column. That was in the spring, summer of 07, and hammered the Oilers forward. That was in the Edmonton Sun. And I know that Kevin Prendergast and myself never really got past that afterwards. But I just, you know, that being said, I wanted the Oilers to take either Sharapanov or Esposito at 15, and I wanted them to take Backlund at 21.
Right.
So I guess I got it half right, but who knew what was going to happen to Sharapanov?
Well, exactly. Let's change subjects and go to Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. You have him making the team. You said like 60 points, didn't you? I want to get you on record there.
Yeah, I said 15 goals and, you know, 55, 60 points. I think this guy's going to make it. And it kills me how there's people out there that are ready to write him off and just say, well, no, he's not ready. How the hell will they know? You know, I mean, when you're talking a player that good, and if you take a history of number one overall picks over the last 20 years, those guys play, Alan. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I don't think there's any question that Nugent Hopkins has the ability to make an impact right from the start. I think we know that. And the size thing is greatly overblown. Nobody had Sam Gagne making the Oilers team in the fall of 07 until he went and played in that Summit Series. And
right.
Nugent Hopkins is a far better player than Sam Gagne at the same age, so I don't know why people wouldn't think that Nugent Hopkins couldn't roll in here on a 30th place team at the time. You know, that being said, when Sam came here, I think the Oilers were 27th or 28th the year before, but it's not like, you know, the Oilers, with the signing of Belanger and with Horkoff and with having Gagne here, they can have a guy like Nugent Hopkins playing 12 minutes some nights. I don't want him playing 6, but if he's not going, he can play 12, and if he's going, he can play 15, 16, 17 minutes.
Do you see him on the power play, like the one or two power play on a regular basis?
Well, come on, obviously, right? I mean, that goes without saying. I think the Oilers will use a combination of 7 forwards and 3 defensemen on their 2 power play units. If you take a look at it, I mean, there's only 3 defensemen really that they have. Unless Petrie makes the team, I guess. You can make an argument there. But, you know, Whitney, Gilbert, and Barker are going to be the 3 power play guys. Like, Schmid's not a power play guy. He needs to focus on being a shutdown defenseman. And with Ladislav Schmid, less is more. I don't even think you need to entertain that discussion because I think it'll confuse the process for him. And we know what Annie Sutton and Theo Pekamar, they're going to be a big, tough third pairing to play against. And Schmid, Sutton, and Peckham, those guys will log the majority of the minutes on the PK.
The Oilers have some tremendous passers now. Hemsky, Nugent Hopkins is a thrill a minute as a passer. He's outstanding. Who do you have as your power play quarterback on the number one power play?
If Whitney's on the point, I could see Whitney and Barker playing the point together on the power play if they end up playing in the same unit, if you keep Gilbert and Schmid together like we saw at the end of last year. And, you know, I think that you could have, I actually think you could have Eberle with, I wouldn't rule it out of possibilities if you went Smith, Eberle, and Nugent Hopkins, and then you went Hall with Horkoff and Hemsky, or Hall with Gagne and Hemsky.
Right.
And that doesn't include Linus Omar, which is the wild card in this equation. So, you know, but I think that's another illustration why you can have Ryan Nugent Hopkins here. People are like, well, he's not strong enough to take faceoffs. Yeah, but Ryan Smith has taken faceoffs in his career, lots of faceoffs in his career, and isn't bad at it. So you can, you know, on Nugent Hopkins' weaker side, maybe Smith takes those draws. And, you know, Smith's a greasy, competitive guy that might be a really good fit because he goes to certain spots for Nugent Hopkins and Jordan Eberle. And conversely, you know, you could have a scenario in which Hall plays with Horkoff and Hemsky, and, you know, we'd have a Triple H line there. And then you go Gagne with Pierre and Omark.
How long before you try in a regular season game Nugent Hopkins between Hall and Eberle? Do you do that early, or do you see if they have some kind of chemistry?
You might see it in the preseason, right at the start.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah.
I mean, I know this. Jordan Eberle said on Oilers Lunch on Wednesday that he was very excited about the possibility of playing with Ryan Nugent Hopkins because they both think the game. Taylor Hall's not the easiest guy to play with. Well, you know, he's Taylor, first of all, if Taylor just shot the puck on two-on-ones, and because his speed creates so many odd man breaks, and he's got very good anticipation. And he cheats a little, too, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's what offensive players do, as long as defensive-minded coaches don't kill him on it. You know, I think that Nugent Hopkins, and Eberle are going to have a really good fit. And in time, Hall will have a good fit too. But right now, Hall's a game breaker that, you know, if he plays with a different type of player like a Horkoff, I think it might accelerate the process for him a little earlier. And then eventually we'll see. I don't know if you can put all three of those guys together right away. Maybe you can look at them in the preseason, but I think that to start the year, maybe Smith will end up playing with a Nugent Hopkins and an Eberle, and maybe we might see Hall with a Horkoff and a Hemsky.
Changing subject a little bit and talking about the bottom six forwards, I've seen and heard and talked to a few people who are somewhat critical of Flushing, Jacques, and Stortini and others from the bottom six a year ago, and adding guys like Eager and Hordachuk to the roster. I have two questions. One, is that an organizational thing, or would Rennie really have dug his heels in and wanted that kind of player? And then the second question is, how much of an upgrade is Eager over a guy like Jacques?
Well, Eager is a substantial upgrade over both of them because he can play. Zach Stortini did some smart things in town. You know, he volunteered to do the community stuff. He developed a relationship with a couple media guys. But after the 2007-08 season, Zach was going the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. Now, he had a good fit there with Brodziak and Glencross at the end of the year, but he wasn't ever as good as that again. And he was going, you know, clearly in the wrong direction. And J.F. Jacques, nobody should be upset they flushed J.F. Jacques. They gave that guy every opportunity to succeed over and over and over again. Unfortunately for J.F. Jacques, he kind of, you know, he rubbed Chris Pronger off the wrong way back in 2006, and it just seemed like it was, you know, something was lost in translation with J.F. Jacques. There was a decent depth player. Stortini, you know, his final act as an Oiler was not throwing punches back in a fight with Chris Bartsch. And when you're a fighter, you can't get your butt kicked that bad. I'm sorry, it's psychologically damaging to your team. At least find a way to tie the guy up and not get your butt kicked in that fashion. So I don't think anybody should be disappointed that either Stortini or Jacques are gone. I'd make an argument the one guy that maybe you could have kept around, I think Hordachuk is a marginal upgrade on a player of McIntyre, but he's not as good a fighter. Mm-hmm. And I look at Eager playing with Belanger and Jones. I think that'll be a pretty good line. And on a given night or when you have some injuries, then you could maybe put in a Hordachuk. And frankly, I mean, a strong argument could have been made that you could have just kept McIntyre instead of Hordachuk. I envision Hordachuk to play.
Right. Some quick ones, Bob. Andrew Cogliano, why was there a hesitation to try him on the wing? Was that him or was that the organization?
No. He was very open-minded, and he really grew a lot over the course of the last 2 years. And this guy was a good Oiler. He wanted to be an Oiler. He changed and grew and matured. You know, 2 seasons ago, I had a conversation with him. I said, you know, you might have to, you know, reinvent yourself as a Todd Marchand clone. And he looked at me and said, Bob, I scored 18 goals the first 2 years in the league, and this was his third year. And he said, I'm not going to, you know, at this stage, I got to try to find a way to make myself a top six forward. And I think that he resigned himself to the fate, given that Edmonton simply brought in better guys. Jordan Eberle on the wing, obviously Taylor Hall, Magnus Piarvi, all three of those players have greater offensive instincts than Andrew Cogliano. So kudos. He certainly was willing to play the wing. His deficiencies in the faceoff circle, really, I mean, Allen's pretty simple. If he had been a 53 or 54% faceoff guy,
yeah,
the Edmonton Oilers would have not signed Eric Belanger.
Yeah.
I think we both know that. So, yeah. But when you're sitting at 42, 43%, they can't trust you at the PK. It behooves Steve Tambellini to do something, and so they stepped up and got Belanger.
Tom Rennie didn't line match much last season that I saw. Do you think he'll do more of that this year with a little more experienced team as opposed to just rolling four lines?
Well, it depends on how you have the line combinations, right? Like, I mean, some people think they should put Smith, Horkoff, and Hemsky, and then if Nugent Hopkins makes the team, go Hall, Nugent Hopkins, and Eberle. If that happens, you know, if you're the opposition team, do you focus on shadowing Smith, Horkoff, and Hemsky? I think you probably would in that scenario, and that might give some softer minutes to that second offensive unit. Sam Gagner is going to be an interesting guy to watch, too, here, because he needs to take a step forward. I think he's capable of it. I think he's capable of a 55-point year, but he needs to reel it in and make it happen this season.
Who do you think he's going to be most likely lined up with, the two Swedes again?
Yeah, I do. Piarvi and Omark. And, you know, I know people said, well, what about Lander? And given the situation the Oilers are in at forward, if Nugent Hopkins makes the team, I got him at 14 forwards without Lander or a guy like Petrell. So I would have Lander on the farm to start the year for the first half of the year, but he is going to weave his way into the fabric of this organization over the next couple of seasons. I don't think there's any debate. I've had two separate NHL general managers ask about him, just in terms of, you know, prior to going to interviews, you know, what do you think of this guy? You know, what's there? And I go, well, they rate him highly. And they're like, well, they should, because he's going to be good.
Right.
One of them actually said, you know, Bob, the Oilers have drafted five of their top seven forwards, if you include their third line center in the last three draft years. They're in a good spot here. And they got another guy. I mean, he was counting Hall and Pjarvi on the left side, Everly on the right side, Nugent Hopkins and Lander at center. Lander is the third line center. And he goes, and they got another guy in Hartikainen who's got a chance to be a top six winger. So they're not in a bad spot. You know, they've got some good forwards. They're building some depth. We haven't even talked about the likes of the Pitlick or Hamilton. We'll see how those guys do moving forward. But forward-wise, they're okay. And you know what? I think realistically, I think we both know that they'll be hard-pressed to make the playoffs. They'll probably be a 20th to 30th team. And I would draft this would be a year that I would draft a defenseman, given the fact there's probably 15 D-men that are going to go in the top 25 of the draft coming up this year.
Any chance that Columbus does some business with us here after the Hoselius injury?
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
If Scott Housen was unwilling to trade Ryan Johansson for Carter, do you think he'd trade him for Hemsky?
No.
Not a chance, right? So, and beyond that, I mean, the Oilers have got five sort of maybes as defense prospects. You know, like I think that Petrie's got a chance to be a top two. Tubert, maybe a top four. Musil, you know, maybe a top four. Marinson's got the wild card. He might be a guy that has, you know, could turn out to be something pretty special. And then Klefbom. So do you need to take on a guy like, you know, Columbus has got one real elite prospect, and that's Johansson. And then there's a substantial drop-off to a guy like Savard or John Moore. You know, do you take one of those guys in a pick for Hemsky? Because you're going to get – that's. I mean, if Hemsky's the replacement, ask yourself a question. Do the Oilers not need to get more for Hemsky than they got for Penner, or at least something similar?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't see Columbus as being the right fit for Hemsky. Now, the wild card might be Omark, because I think that you know, Omark, what do you think Omark's worth on the open market?
Well, he's an enticing player in that he looks like he's going to be very good. He's very inexpensive, and he's a plug-and-play player. You could put him in your top – well, some teams could put him in their top six right now.
Yeah, but I'm not – I think what Housen tries to do is he's going to watch – he's going to monitor New York, you know, depending on how much money Dubinsky and Callahan sign for. They'll get those guys done. Those guys are the heart and soul of the Rangers. And if it's too much, then Volsky will get bought out. And if Volsky doesn't get bought out, if Volsky gets bought out, then the Rangers' second move is to turn around and sign a guy like Prosper for cheap, right? To kind of replace what Volsky was going to do. So if Volsky gets capped, that means Prosper's going to be on the market. And maybe a guy like Prosper ends up in Columbus on a one-year deal.
Bob, thanks for this. Have a great weekend.
You too, Alan. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bob Stauffer, of course, from Team 1260, Oilers Broadcasts. And, well, he's all over the place on Oilers.com as well. We appreciate his time. Some interesting insight there into how he sees the Edmonton Oilers lining up. Some interesting, you know, and we're months away from it, but there's some interesting decisions for the Edmonton Oilers to make. And one item that he mentioned that I really want to draw attention to is the Ryan Whitney factor at the beginning of training camp and the beginning of the season. That injury does take some time to recover from, and that may impact how this team enters the starting gate for the National Hockey League season in 11-12. It's 11:48. We'll be back. It's 1:48. We'll be back right after this.